The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this episode of The Conspiracy Vault. I'm your speaker, Casey, and for this episode, we will be looking at one of the biggest musicians of all time. Someone who changed the face of music in the 90s and forever on, before dying at the young age of 27. Today, we are going to be looking at rock legend Kurt Cobain. On July 31st, 1965, Donald Leland Cobain, born 1946, and Wendy Elizabeth, born 1948, married each other in Idaho, a state in the Pacific Northwest of America. 2 years later, they would welcome their first child into the world. Baby Kurt Donald Cobain was born February 20th, 1967. Eventually, Donald and Wendy would go on to have two more children, girls named Kimberly and Brianne. Working as a mechanic, Donald was a proud man. Wendy was a waitress, and together the family seemed outwardly positive. Young Cobain was described by many as a happy child who showed an early interest and adeptness at anything musical. Having a few musicians in the family, Kurt was said to be singing as early as two and picking up keyboards and guitars as young as four. As the first grandchild on both sides of the family, he was doted on and very much loved. At the age of seven, Kurt became increasingly hyperactive. Friends and family talked of how he would knock things over and struggled to stay still. This eventually led to Kurt being given a prescription for Ritalin. The medication caused complications with sleep and insomnia, and to counter this, Cobain would eventually be medicated with sedatives alongside the Ritalin. This medicated state at the tender age of seven would be the start of a short life full of medicinal-driven decisions and identity. At the age of nine, life for Cobain changed drastically. His parents divorced, and he saw this as something to be embarrassed about, later referring to the whole situation as shameful. This somewhat saw the beginning of Cobain's rebellious and antisocial personality. His father promised not to remarry, but eventually broke that promise when he went on to marry a lady named Jenny Westerby. Jenny and her two children, Mindy and James, moved into Cobain's father's home. Hopping between the two homes of his mother and father, Cobain's behaviour appeared to become more challenging, with more boundaries being tested and more antisocial views cementing themselves. However, the maternal affection Cobain was given from his new stepmother, Jenny, seemed to have a desired effect when Cobain began responding to her positively, accepting her into his new life. However, in January 1979, Jenny gave birth to a little baby boy whom the family named Chad. This spelled the end of Cobain's warmth towards his stepmother, renouncing his new situation, claiming that these people were not his family. During this time, Cobain's mother had begun dating somebody else herself. According to reports, the relationship had spiraled into regular accounts of domestic abuse, with Wendy's arm even being broken at one point. Being witness to this abuse, Cobain was also subjected to bullying and harassment at the hands of his mother's new lover. Expecting his mother to press charges and leave this partner behind in light of a better life with her son, Cobain soon became resentful of Wendy when none of these things happened. He distanced himself from his mother and started moving between grandparents, aunts, and uncles. Eventually, he would end up back with his father, who only tolerated Cobain's behaviour for a short time before dropping him off with his mother Wendy, leaving him on the doorstep. According to some family and friends, at this time, Cobain had become somewhat of a bully himself, treating his mum poorly, and also started complaining of intense stomach pains that medication didn't seem to manage. Cobain's behaviour continued down the path of antisocial and even started to move towards anti-establishment. He supposedly joined the school wrestling team, and as his father stood in the crowd watching, Cobain purposefully threw the match just to spite his onlooking father. He also began getting into trouble with police and smoking marijuana. Full of angst, Cobain began drawing pictures that family and teachers described as disturbing or inappropriate. Cobain was also full of raging hormones and desperate to lose his virginity, so much so that he attempted to have sex with a girl in his year who was intellectually disabled, someone Cobain and his friends used to visit to steal alcohol from. Despite her agreeing to the experience, Cobain later went on to say that he struggled to get an erection, and so his first attempt at sexual intercourse was a failure, but his peers at school soon found out. As well as supposedly bullying another kid in school, Cobain too was the subject of bullying on the assumption by some of his peers that he was gay. Cobain later went on to say that he liked that people thought he was gay, especially if that meant that people didn't like him because of this. He would say that he liked being gay even though he wasn't, and even had a gay best friend in school, which during the 80s was not widely accepted. Despite having this label, he was also known in school as, and this is a term that I do not support in any way, and I do feel somewhat uncomfortable saying it, a retard fucker. Because of this particular label, Cobain went on to attempt suicide. He did this by lying down on the train tracks, awaiting his decided fate. However, the train switched tracks last minute, sparing Cobain's life. Eventually, after a failed attempt at therapy suggested by Donald, Kurt's father, and fed up with his behaviour and unwillingness to find a job, and his mother not wanting to leave her partner, which added to the household tensions, Wendy kicked Kurt out of her home. Kurt Cobain began couch surfing, jumping from house to house as his friends would offer him shelter. Eventually, he found himself in Olympia, Washington. Whilst staying on friends' couches, Cobain became involved in jamming sessions, picking up a guitar and playing it for hours on end, discovering or rediscovering his deep love for music and ease for picking up instruments. Cobain's first band was formed in 1985. The name? Fecal Matter. Disbanding in 1986, Cobain soon began playing music with a friend from his Aberdeen High School and future bandmate and bassist Chris Novoselic, and using the practice space of the then successful band The Melvins, the pair created their first project. They named themselves The Sellouts, a Creedence Clearwater Revival tribute band. Eventually, they began a different project. In the same area as the pair at this time, there were successful bands emerging, such as Alice in Chains, Soundgarden and Pearl Jam, all contributing to the new genre known as grunge, about to erupt onto the scenes, was perhaps the most influential contribution to this genre to this very day, Nirvana. But first, the group had to go through some teething problems and various name changes. Known under other names such as Skid Row, Pencap Chew, Ted Edfred, and even considered such names as Godchild, Drugs for Sale, and Syringe, before finally settling on the name Nirvana. Forming in 1987, the original band members were made up of Kurt Cobain, Chris Novoselic, and Aaron Kirkhard on drums, initially practicing Cobain's Fecal Matter material before quickly moving on to writing their own songs. After moving around and eventually relocating, the band had various members drop in and out for a number of reasons, eventually settling with Chad Channing on drums, who would make up the third member and play one of Nirvana's first live gigs in May 1988. Kurt Cobain was interviewed at one point claiming that Nirvana were, quote, an alternative grunge rock band, and in June 1989 they released their first album, Bleach, which included a song title, About a Girl, which Cobain had supposedly written about an earlier romantic involvement with a lady called Tracy Miranda. This meant that by the time Dave Grohl joined in 1990 on drums, having replaced Kent Stax on drums in the band Scream and then having Scream disband, and with Cobain on guitar and vocals and Chris Novoselic on bass, when the album Nevermind was released in 1991, the three cemented members of Nirvana were about to make music history. Released on September 24th in 1991, and after three solid weeks of recording, the album finally dropped. It included tracks such as Smells Like Teen Spirit, Lithium and Come As You Are. It sold 6,000 units in the week it landed, and the album found itself placing at a cool 144 in the Billboard charts. It would eventually top the charts and spend a total of 361 weeks in the charts and go on to sell 10 million copies. What followed was unprecedented in music history so far. According to MusicRadar.com, in the 2 years that followed Nevermind, there were not only number one albums for Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Stone Temple Pilots and Alice in Chains, but even Mudhoney, The Melvins and Tad and the Vaselines were signed to major labels. Without Nevermind clearing the way, these bands and their punk overtones would never have been allowed anywhere near the mainstream. The hit-packed Nevermind may have been an unlikely Trojan horse by which punk entered the 90s mainstream, but then again, it was an album full of contradictions. By this time, Cobain had developed a much darker drug habit. His use of substances had progressed to heroin, and this became his drug of choice. Apparently, his first time using the drug was back in 1986, according to bandmate Chris Novoselic. But there is a quote from Kurt Cobain about how his habit escalated. Radio X has an article that reads, "Kurt Cobain's use of heroin became more worrying when he started to use the drug to self-medicate, to relieve the pain of an undiagnosed stomach condition. It started with 3 days in a row of doing heroin, and I don't have stomach pain," Cobain told Nirvana biographer Michael Azarad. "That was such a relief," end quote. By this point, Cobain was romantically involved with a fellow heroin user called Courtney Love. According to insiders, the pair first met in 1990. Love explained her initial reaction to Cobain during an interview, sharing that she was instantly taken with him. Quote, "He was super cute, but he carried himself as someone who didn't know that." According to Wikipedia, Courtney Michelle Harrison was born on July 9, 1964, at St. Francis Memorial Hospital in San Francisco, California, the first child of psychotherapist Linda Carroll and Hank Harrison, a publisher and road manager for the Grateful Dead. And this point stood out to me as I have currently been doing a lot of research around Charles Manson for the Patreon series. Love's parents were in with a lot of famous people. Phil Lesh, the founding bassist of the Grateful Dead, is Love's godfather. According to Love, she was named after Courtney Farrell, the protagonist of Pamela Moore's 1956 novel Chocolates for Breakfast. Love is of Cuban, English, German, Irish and Welsh descent. Another link to the Manson family was Courtney Love living in Haight-Ashbury with her parents until they divorced when she was 6 years old, with her mum winning a drawn-out and ugly custody battle, with allegations that Hank had been dosing family members with LSD, mother and daughter moved to Oregon. Before long, Linda remarried to a man named Frank Rodriguez, and together they had two daughters, and Frank legally adopted Love. They also had a son who sadly died in infancy from a heart defect when Love was only 10 years old. The family would eventually go on to adopt a little boy. In Eugene, Love attended school where she was said to struggle academically. At one point, she was seen by a psychologist who diagnosed Love as having signs of autism. Despite this diagnosis, Love recalls growing up in a chaotic household with naked people she describes as hippies running through the house as she grew up. At age 8, her family moved to New Zealand, but eventually in 1973, Love was sent back to Oregon to be brought up by her stepfather. At age 14, Love was arrested for shoplifting, and during her stint in juvenile hall, whilst on remand, she was introduced to music. She listened to Patti Smith and the Pretenders and was inspired to start her own band. As her family life continued to deteriorate and without her mother to care for her or without her stepfather's support, Courtney Love was in and out of foster care until she was emancipated in 1980. She eventually moved to Japan to work in a topless bar, but her passport was confiscated 2 months later. Back in Oregon, she continued to work in topless bars to make money, changing her name to the now infamous one, known by millions, Courtney Love. This is her identity that would stay with her for life. Love would toy with music as she continued to travel to various countries to dance in topless bars, finding more love for music as she went along. Love struggled to find a project that would take her and keep her, and she struggled to set up her own musical project where no one could fire her. Working odd jobs, including a DJ at a gay disco, Love said she lacked social skills and learned them while frequenting gay clubs and spending time with drag queens. During this period, she enrolled at the Portland State University, studying English and philosophy. After receiving a maternal trust fund and moving around some more, she later went to Alaska, where she could work without being recognized. But still, she wasn't satisfied. Love wanted to become famous and would stop at nothing to achieve this. In late 88, she moved back to LA where she taught herself guitar and got a band together called Hole, after her mother told her she couldn't live her life, quote, with a hole running through her. Hole went on to get quite big in the music scene. They reached number one in the UK, and somehow Courtney Love became the poster child of the Riot Girl movement, of which she actually had no affiliation with. Courtney Love and Kurt Cobain formally met in a nightclub in Portland, Seattle on the 12th of January 1990, but Love had apparently developed a crush on the Nirvana frontman after seeing him perform at a gig the year before. Cobain appeared to dismiss Love's advances at first, commenting, quote, I was determined to be a bachelor for a few months, but I knew I liked Courtney so much right away that it was a really hard struggle to stay away from her for so many months, end quote. By the time the pair met, Love was already known for having starred in the Joe Strummer movie Straight to Hell, and Nirvana were also quickly growing in fame. Eventually, after finally coming into contact with one another, and reportedly rolling around on the floor after a gig and play fighting, the bond between the two was solidified quickly. Some say through their common interest in drugs. Love married Cobain on Waikiki Beach in Honolulu, Hawaii, on February the 24th, 1992. Cobain famously wore his pajamas to the wedding ceremony, while Love donned a white lace and satin gown. Among the eight guests was Cobain's Nirvana bandmate and now Foo Fighters frontman Dave Grohl. At the time of their wedding, Courtney Love was already pregnant with their daughter Frances. The image of the sonogram is on Nirvana's Lithium single artwork. Their daughter, Frances Bean, was born on 18th of August 1992. The REM frontman Michael Stipe and actress Drew Barrymore are her godparents. The same year Frances was born, Love gave an interview with Vanity Fair where she reportedly admitted to using heroin whilst pregnant, unaware of her condition. Love later claimed that she had been misquoted and also stated she had stopped taking drugs upon the news of her pregnancy. Eventually, Child Welfare Services launched an investigation into their parenting abilities and stepped in. The investigation was ultimately dismissed, but not without a significant amount of legal wrangling, and Frances being removed from her parents' custody for a short amount of time, beginning when she was only 2 weeks old. According to thesun.co.uk, her birth was preceded by the revelation that Courtney was taking heroin during the pregnancy, something the star denied and claimed had been taken out of context in an interview. Frances was removed from her parents' custody for a period during her infancy and was only returned after legal proceedings. According to family and friends, as time went on, Courtney Love and Kurt Cobain's love became more toxic. They would fight more often, and Love became jealous of her famous husband's ever-growing money and fan base. There are claims that Courtney believed that she should be, or would be, more famous and successful than her husband and his bandmates in Nirvana. According to RollingStone.com, in February 1993, Cobain had one goal in mind: to bring the band back to their punk rock roots. Their millions of new fans may have revered Nevermind, but Cobain thought it sounded candy ass and way too commercial, so he recruited esteemed engineer Steve Albini, who had recorded Pixies, The Breeders, The Jesus Lizard and other Cobain faves, and headed for the woods in rural Minnesota to create an album that had much more in common with their debut album Bleach. The result was In Utero, 41 minutes of raw, uncompromising rock that was unlike anything else in the pop landscape. Cobain, disenchanted by his overwhelming fame and the widespread media coverage of his personal life, was ready to vent. From the opening lines of Serve the Servants, Teenage Angst Has Paid Off Well, to the moving finale of All Apologies, All in All Is All We Are, Cobain's bleak world view was on full display. Many of the songs are best remembered for their gut-wrenching, stripped-back acoustic renditions on MTV Unplugged, but In Utero is treasured among hardcore Nirvana fans in their purest form. There are reports at this point that Courtney Love and Kurt Cobain were spending around $300 a day to maintain their ever-growing heroin habit. During Nirvana's tour stop in Munich in 1994, Cobain was diagnosed with bronchitis and severe laryngitis. He was then sent to Rome for medical treatment, where he met his wife Courtney Love. According to Love, on March 3, 1994, she awoke to find Cobain had overdosed on champagne and Rohypnol. The singer was then rushed to hospital, where he stayed for 5 days. He slipped into a pharmacological coma and had his stomach pumped, despite Love claiming that the overdose was intentional and he, quote, took like 50 pills. He probably doesn't even remember how many he took, end quote. His record label, Gold Mountain Records, ascertained that this was not intentional and the overdose was a result of Cobain recovering from his bout of bronchitis. After that event, Cobain and Love had a domestic issue whereby Love called the police to their Seattle home. Authorities confiscated 3 guns and some pills from Cobain, who had locked himself in a bedroom upstairs. According to Cobain, he wasn't trying to take his own life, like Courtney had told the police, but was hiding from Courtney Love. Sources suggest that they had been in another argument, and Cobain took himself to the bathroom and locked the door behind himself just to be away from tumultuous Courtney. According to reports, Kurt's commitment to Courtney Love, to Nirvana, and to anything other than being wayward and taking drugs had taken a back seat. Courtney Love was said to be worried about Kurt Cobain dying by accidental or purposeful overdose. However, others have suggested that she was worried about him running from his band and not bringing any more money, so Courtney Love staged an intervention to convince Kurt to seek help for his drug use and depression. According to biography.com, in late March, Love, Nirvana's Chris Novoselic and Pat Smear, along with several other friends, went through with staging an intervention at Cobain's home. During the meeting, Courtney Love reportedly threatened to leave Cobain, with whom she shared daughter Frances Bean, and his band also issued an ultimatum of breaking up the band should he not agree to seek treatment at a rehabilitation facility. Others have suggested that those present in the intervention only had their ulterior motives in mind, getting Kurt Cobain into a position to continue making music and making money. This included Courtney Love, Nirvana, and even the band manager. Some have argued that a family or friend should have been present, not someone who had lots to lose from Cobain leaving the band or this world, and lots to gain if he carried on making music. Some have suggested his aunt, whom he was close with growing up, who had nothing to gain from gaining access to Kurt, heroin and money, would have been a good person to have at an intervention like this. However, after some time, Cobain finally agreed to go to rehab in Los Angeles. On April 1, 1994, Frances visited her father at the Exodus Recovery Center, a rehab center in Marina del Rey, California, where they played together. This was the last time she would see her father alive. Cobain then broke out of rehab by jumping a 6-foot brick wall and got a flight back to Seattle, but friends and family were unaware of his whereabouts. What happens in the next few days is not clear and remains one of the biggest mysteries of grunge music history and popular culture to this very day. And this is the mystery of Kurt Cobain's final movements. It was later revealed that before heading to the treatment center in Marina del Rey, Kurt Cobain paid a visit to pal Dylan Carlson, who also participated in the aforementioned intervention at his Seattle home on March 30th. Citing problems with trespassers on his property, Cobain asked for some help in securing a firearm. "He seemed normal. We'd been talking," Carlson later said. "Plus, I'd loaned him guns before." Cobain gave him $300 to buy a 20-gauge shotgun and a box of ammunition from Stan's gun shop. Knowing that Cobain was about to depart for treatment near Los Angeles, Carlson said that his friend's need for the purchase did give him pause. "It seemed kind of weird that he was buying a shotgun before he was leaving, so I offered to hold on to it until he got back," end quote. Cobain, however, insisted on keeping the weapon himself, and according to police, he likely dropped off the gun at his home before travelling to the Exodus Recovery Center in Marina del Rey later that day. He was only in rehab for 2 days before fleeing, and there is a suggested timeline, although it could be the case that no one really knows what happened. And if there are a few that do, they still remain tight-lipped to this very day. Biography.com goes on to say, police suspect he flew back to Seattle, where he spent his final days wandering, with neighbours claiming to have spotted an ill-looking Cobain in a park near his home, dressed in a heavy coat, which they deemed inappropriate for April weather. Others have suggested he may have spent a night with an unidentified friend at his nearby summer home. On the 8th of April 1994, an electrician who was installing an alarm discovered Kurt Cobain's deceased body at his home on Lake Washington Boulevard. Later, the coroner report stated that Cobain had actually died on April the 5th, 3 days before. Law enforcement officials believe Cobain had barricaded himself inside the greenhouse where an electrician who came to the home to install a security system discovered his body. Love later recounted to MTV that after taking drugs, Cobain used the shotgun Coulson had helped him to purchase days earlier to shoot himself in the head, thus ending his short life. She also said that her husband left a note in red ink that she read at a Seattle memorial service. Many accounts have come out since of people not believing that Kurt took his own life, that somehow Courtney Love is behind the tragic event through masterminding a plan and paying someone to carry out the act of murdering her husband. There is even an entire documentary dedicated to the idea that Kurt Cobain didn't kill himself. It was released in 2015 and is titled Soaked in Bleach. It is based on private investigator Tom Grant, who was originally hired by Courtney Love in the days between Kurt leaving rehab and being found dead in his Seattle home, to track down the lead singer and tell Courtney Love his exact whereabouts. In the book, The World's Worst Conspiracies, The Things They Don't Want You to Know, by Mike Rothschild, it says, Cobain's suicide did indeed seem out of character to people who knew him, even as his health problems worsened to the point where he had briefly been in a coma a month earlier due to an accidental overdose of painkillers. And so it didn't take long for theories to emerge that because suicidal ideation was out of character for Cobain, he could not have actually done it. There are a slew of claims and counterclaims regarding Cobain's death, some supported by evidence and some not. The most prevalent conspiracy theory is that Courtney Love was involved, usually by paying a hitman to kill him and stage it like a suicide. Her motive is thought to be money, and more specifically that Cobain was about to cut her out of his will. Its main proponent is private investigator Tom Grant, originally hired by Love to look into why Cobain had left his drug rehab, only to uncover evidence that Cobain had been planning to divorce Love. Backing them up are several high-profile documentaries, one called Kurt and Courtney, which has on-camera testimony from a musician named Eldon Hoke claiming that Love offered him $50,000 to kill Cobain in a staged suicide, and Soaked in Bleach, whose makers Love sued to have its release stopped and whose conspiracies were said to be endorsed by Cobain's own mother. All these claims rely on some basic assumptions: that Cobain was too high on heroin to actually be able to pull the trigger on the shotgun, that the gun had 3 shells loaded into it, that the suicide note makes no actual mention of suicide until the last few lines, which don't appear to be in the same handwriting, and that Eldon Hoke mysteriously died in an accident shortly after appearing to confess his role in the murder. Above all, they believe that Cobain's death saved Love from losing millions in a divorce, and that Love has taken no legal action against any of the conspiracy theorists who accused her of conspiracy to murder her husband, because doing so would lay bare her true role. The Soaked in Bleach documentary explores experiments done to try and reenact what the body would be capable of given the amount of heroin in Kurt's body. It talks of Courtney Love being holed up in some hotel room doing a kind of drug detox despite there still being lots of drugs around. It talks of Courtney Love's ex-partner, Callie Thornhill Dewitt, who was now the live-in nanny at Kurt and Courtney's Seattle home, taking care of Frances Bean, being involved somehow. Shown in the documentary, but also according to allthatsinteresting.com, it was initially reported that Cobain's mother, Wendy O'Connor, had filed a missing persons report stating that the Nirvana frontman had a shotgun and may be suicidal, but according to Grant, it was actually Courtney Love who had filed the missing persons report in O'Connor's name. It's unclear why Love would have wanted to pose as O'Connor, but Grant used this information as part of his overall summary of events, hinting that Love was being elusive about her husband early on in the investigation. After Cobain's body was discovered, Grant felt bewildered when he heard the suicide ruling. Despite the official story being given by authorities, Grant clearly had some doubts, but it wasn't until December 1994 that he started publicly raising questions about Cobain's death and talking about the suspicious things he'd observed during his investigation. There are several reasons why Tom Grant thinks Kurt Cobain was murdered, but at the core of his reasoning lies the belief that Kurt Cobain couldn't have injected himself with such a large amount of heroin, 3 times a lethal dose, and then be able to shoot himself. Grant believes that even a heroin addict would have been incapacitated and unable to pick up a gun. Another reason why Grant believes that Kurt Cobain was murdered is because of inconsistencies in his suicide note. Grant thinks that the top half of Cobain's letter was meant to announce that he intended to leave the music business behind, but since the bottom half of the note has a different content and mentions love and Cobain's daughter Frances, he thinks it could have been written by someone else. There are also suggestions that Kurt Cobain did not barricade himself in the guest house because there was only one small simple lock on the door that was engaged when law enforcement arrived. Strangely, the documentary suggests that Courtney Love kept getting people to go to the house to look for Cobain under the pretense that work needed doing on the house at strange times of the day or week. This is how an electrician ends up being the person to find Kurt Cobain's body. This alludes to Courtney Love knowing Kurt was there and needed someone to find him and alert the authorities. The fact that Kurt Cobain has had suicide in his family history has been used to prove that it may have been more likely that Cobain would have committed suicide. But it has also since come forward that one of those suicides was actually an uncle who dropped his gun and accidentally shot himself, not an intentional suicide. This is all explained in the liveformusic.com feature on Kurt Cobain that reads, Tom Grant's theory leans heavily on the amount of morphine in Cobain's blood, as heroin turns to morphine once it enters a person's bloodstream. The level in Cobain was triple the maximum lethal dose to a severe addict. Grant's contention is that with this much heroin in his bloodstream, Cobain could not have lifted the model 11-20-gauge shotgun to his mouth and pulled the trigger. The autopsy has never been released to the public, so the exact amount of drugs in Cobain's bloodstream is based on a newspaper account. Experts still debate whether or not Cobain could have fired the gun under these circumstances. Original reports stated that Cobain was barricaded in the small greenhouse room with a stool wedged up against the door. In truth, a simple push button was all that sealed the room. Someone potentially could have simply pushed the button and closed the door behind them as they left. Reports said that Cobain left his license out for identification purposes in case disfigurement hid his identity. In reality, a police officer had removed the license from the singer's wallet, which then was photographed in pictures taken at the scene. The suicide note left actually seemed to describe that Cobain was quitting Nirvana and had tired of stardom. Nirvana member Dave Grohl confirmed years later that the group was breaking up, in an appearance he made on the Howard Stern programme. The size of the writing at the end of the note changed dramatically, and it was only there that Cobain seemed to say a permanent goodbye to his wife and young daughter. Tom Grant was also concerned that the gun, the shells, and the note all had no discernible fingerprints, and the note appeared to be, at least in key parts, a forgery. The gun was not checked for prints by authorities until May 6, 1994, a full month later. The note was only released because Tom Grant pretended to need glasses to read it when Courtney showed it to him, but he asked to run a copy of her fax machine. The autopsy was completed on April 8, 1994, the same day Cobain's body was discovered. In a case full of unexpected twists and turns, the coroner was Dr. Nicholas Hartshorn, the producer of several Nirvana concerts who had personally known Cobain and Love. Critics allege that the case should have been investigated as a homicide and not initially begun with the conclusion of suicide as it moved forward. Hartshorn later was killed in a BASE jumping accident in Switzerland on August 6, 2002. Tom Grant went on the Tom Lakers radio programme and stated bluntly that Courtney Love and Michael Callie DeWitt were involved in a conspiracy to kill Kurt Cobain. Love responded to Grant's allegations by offering him work on different cases, which he feels was a bribe. DeWitt was in the Cobain home when Cobain was missing and had seen Kurt there as DeWitt lay in semi-sleep in bed. A note DeWitt left for Kurt to call Courtney is believed by Grant to have been staged. DeWitt was himself an active heroin user and former boyfriend of Courtney Love. Love later had DeWitt's father do extensive renovations to her home and got Callie a lucrative job at Geffen Records. Tom Grant told L4LM that he was not giving interviews until a 2015 documentary told from his perspective, soaked in bleach, was released. He did consent to answer a question on whether Cobain had nitrates on his hands from firing a shotgun. He said that nitrates are meaningless in this case. He went on to say that anyone standing in a small to medium-sized room with their hands exposed, especially the palms, like in a robbery where the gunman orders the victim to raise his or her hands, would test positive for gunshot residue with a gun, rifle or shotgun, where the gunshot residue is carried by the air in the room like a sneeze. Nitrates end up on exposed surfaces, including the hands of someone who did not pull the trigger. Grant went on to say that most gunshot residue is invisible to the naked eye unless the weapon were fired at very close range. So, of course, Cobain would have had gunshot residue on his hands and face whether he was murdered or committed suicide. From the time Courtney Love hired Tom Grant to locate Kurt Cobain, he began to tape nearly every conversation he had with her. Grant has these recordings of Love discussing Cobain seeking a divorce from her. Many of the tapes can be played on Grant's website, CobainCase.com. Love and Cobain had a prenuptial agreement as she seemed initially destined to become the bigger star. When Cobain's light wound up shining more brightly, Love stood to suffer financially if the couple divorced. Grant also theorises that Love also would potentially gain considerable sympathy if Cobain committed suicide rather than divorced her. In Grant's mind, this was the motive behind what he labels a murder. In the days after Kurt's death, fans came out in droves to show their support for the family and to mourn the death of the grunge frontman and pioneer of the music genre. Many wore black t-shirts to school, and there was a rise in teen suicide. At this time, a lot went into suicide prevention and awareness, calling a need for better support systems around mental health and suicidal ideation, which there can never be enough of in today's age. On August 18, 2010, Frances Bean Cobain inherited 37% of her late father's estate. She now controls the publicity rights to her father's name and image instead of Courtney Love. During Cobain's divorce proceedings from Isaiah Silver, it was revealed that she earned from July 2016 until June 2017 $95,496 per month from the royalties related to her father's estate in addition to $6,784 per month in dividends, $102,280 total per month, or $1.2 million per year. Her net worth is estimated at approximately $11.3 million. Her father's estate was valued in 2014 as being worth $450 million. Cobain tragically joined the infamous 27 Club, a group of famous and influential people who lost their lives at age 27. Included in this list is Jimi Hendrix, Amy Winehouse, Janis Joplin, Brian Jones, Jim Morrison, and the late, great Kurt Donald Cobain. So what do you think happened? Do you think this was a case of organised murder, a crime of passion, or is the official story the true story, that a disenchanted Kurt Cobain with an excessive drug habit and the pressure of the world from his spouse, fans and bandmates, a history of depression and excruciating stomach pains, and made this enough for Kurt to end his own life? Did his resentment at becoming the voice of a generation become too much to bear on top of everything else? Or is there something to be said for Tom Grant's investigation, for the recordings he made, for the divorce that Cobain wanted from Love, from the handwriting practice sheet that they found in her bag that could maybe have matched up with the suicide note, for the overwhelming drugs in his system that may have made it impossible for him to shoot himself, from somebody saying that Courtney Love offered them $50,000 if they were to kill Kurt Cobain? Get in touch and let me know your thoughts at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or follow me on Twitter and Instagram at cultvaultpod. I'm your speaker, Casey, and this has been The Conspiracy Vault.